Welcome to Highway Diary. I'm your host, Eric Hollerbach. With me, Angelo Gingerelli on quarantine.
What's going on, Eric? How you doing, man?
How's it going, buddy? So the Brighton Bar, where you host the mic on Monday nights, is shut down.
Yeah, man. The mic is on hiatus, as is pretty much everything else in New Jersey right now. I know you were a radio there. I think we had a good thing going. I think we're going to have a good thing going when we get to do it again. We're just kind of on an indefinite hiatus, kind of like the rest of the state is.
Yeah, I'm, like, going out of my mind because, like, two things keep me sane. Like, one is doing stand-up and telling jokes, and I cannot do that in any way, shape, or form. And then the other thing is, like, working out, and, like, even my gym is closed. They're still billing me every month, but my gym is closed. I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah. I guess you're pretty similar, man, because I like those two things a lot, too. And I've been running a lot, and I was doing, up until very recently, like, workouts in the park around my house, like pull-ups, push-ups, that kind of stuff. And then they shut the park down this week. At least, like, that part of the park, you can still run around. You can't really use the pull-up bars anymore. So it's been tough, man. It's been challenging.
Yeah, behind me is a little park. I just in Edison here, and there's police tape around the freaking jungle gym.
Yeah, that's what we have, man. Police tape, and they locked all the gates with like kind of like plastic ties kind of thing where you can't open them and go in.
Ridiculous. So what's going on with you? You said now you're doing more dad duties. You were sharing that responsibility. What's going on in your household?
Well, my house, I'm always kind of on dad duty. I have a 4.5-year-old daughter, and she's great. She's going to kindergarten next year. She's in pre-K now. And then me and my wife, we live together. We're a married couple. So we kind of split that. Usually my wife's cool enough to take control of our daughter on Monday night so I can rush home from work, eat something real quick, and get to Brighton. And then, you know, like on Tuesday and Thursday, she works. Wednesday, I'll take our daughter and do whatever I got to do with her. But since we're home, man, we're both trying to work from home and deal with our daughter and get her schoolwork done and keep her, you know, physically active. It's just a lot, man. You got to get teachers and you know, child care workers just a lot of credit because being with a kid all day is not easy. And being in a room with 15 of them, I can't even imagine.
So you're doing, like, homework from home type of thing? You got to mail it in? Or how's that work?
It's online. So there's a website, I guess, the New Jersey schools are using, and they kind of give you lesson plans and homework, and you can submit stuff online and you can print out worksheets or you can do them online either way.
It's really weird.
And we kind of lucked out, man, because, you know, she's in pre-K. She's not even in kindergarten yet, so there's not a ton of work. But I'm assuming if you have, like a 6th, 7th grader, it's a significant amount of work you got to dedicate every day just to keep the kid on pace with what they would be doing in school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're starting to do, like, high-level algebra and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. And the thing is, too, I think people are – I mean, obviously the health concern is the biggest thing with the coronavirus. And then, I guess, secondly, we're going to talk about the economics of it when a small business like the Brighton Bar can't open – for weeks or months at a time. But then, like, educationally, think about if you're a junior or senior in high school now and your SATs got canceled and your ACT test got canceled and all of your applications to college are on hold. And there's people, depending where you are in your life, that this is really putting your whole life on hold. Whereas, like, somebody my age, I'm just going to go back to my job when this is over. My daughter's going to go to kindergarten next year. But if you're, like, in a certain, you know, certain demographics, this is really affecting the next 10 plus years of your life, depending on what you're doing, right?
Yeah, so apparently they also canceled, like, the college A-level Division I wrestling tournament. So, like, if your whole life was wrestling, the tournament is supposed to set up who goes to the Olympics. That's gone. Imagine
right.
If you're about to go in the combine for the NFL draft. Your whole life is gone. You know?
Or, you know, if you're even a high school or college baseball player with hopes of getting drafted, your season is over. Right? So now your draft and your signing bonus and how you're really going to be able to live the next 10 plus years of your life is going to be determined by what you've already done. You don't have a chance to make that last statement season and get drafted higher and make more money for yourself and your family. Same with the NCAA tournament for basketball. We all have room for March Madness. It's fun to do pools and whatever and have a good time rooting for those kids. But if you're a potential NBA draft pick, this has altered the course of your life, right? Because you're on track to be a lottery pick and make a max contract, and now no one has any film to watch on you, and you stumble down to out of the top 20 picks or whatever, you go from making millions to making hundreds of thousands, which is, you know, that's life-changing money.
Unbelievable. Even, you know, just – and then you go local, like the bar at the end of my block that I used to watch sports at, that's That's shut down. You can't even get chicken wings to go. They're just done.
You know? Those are the people. I don't know how long you've been doing stand-up, but I've been doing it consistently at the Jersey Shore since 2013, right? So in the last 7 years, those bartenders, those bouncers, those venue owners, those waiters and waitresses, those DJs and sound guys have become some of my best friends. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I live in Long Branch. I do a lot of shows in Asbury, and I have a lot of close friends that are comics, but you see comics sporadically. Me and you might do a show together this week, and we might not be on another show together until next month, right?
Right, right.
But those people that are working in the venues, you see them consistently, and you're just with them all the time, and they're struggling now because they're just their entire revenue stream is completely dried up, which I just feel bad, man. I've been trying to post on Facebook and support local business as much as I can, but then, there's only so much you can do if the venues are just closing and not allowing you to spend money there anymore.
Yeah, and also, imagine, the Comedy Store. Like, for all the 90s, the Comedy Store was, in the dark ages. Nobody was coming, the early 2000s. All of a sudden, Joe Rogan comes through. They start, selling out every show every time. And those waitresses, they hire more, and now everything is gone. I don't know. It's just, can we talk a little bit about the old days? So the first time I met you, Angelo, I come out to the Brighton Bar, and I've talked about this three times now, but it left quite an impression on me where there was a list, and I signed the list, I got there early, and then this red-headed renegade comic comes up, he grabs a list, he sets it on fire, and then you had to send a new list. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do know what you're talking about. It's a night that lives in infamy, man, and number one, I'm amazed that was your first night there. Number two, I want to apologize for that. And number three, thanks for coming back. And number four, can we both agree things have gotten much better since that night?
Yeah, it was kind of shocking to me. I showed up with Brian St. John to do a podcast, and I was like, whoa, this place is fucking wild. You know?
Here's what happened that night, just to let everybody know, because there was a lot of people there. There's a woman named Heather Lowry who's a comic from Long Branch like myself, and she was running the Brighton Bar mic for all of 2018. Did a great job with it. It got bigger. It was consistent. She had 20-plus comics every night, and she's a cool person. And at the end of 2018, she decided she couldn't do it anymore. She had some personal stuff going on, didn't want to commit to it every Monday. I live down the street from the Brighton Bar. She asked me to take over, right? So I'm like, great. This is a perfect thing because it gives me a perfect place to perform every Monday. It's down the street from my house. I know the people that own it and work there already. It's a slam dunk, right?
Yeah.
So January goes by, it goes pretty well. February goes by, it goes pretty well. First week in March, which is the week you're talking about, I had a death in my family up in North Jersey. I had to go to the wake, right? So I go up to the wake. I hit traffic on the way back. I'm 7 minutes late to put the list out at Brighton Bar. In that 7 minutes, two people put two different lists out, right? And they were just pieces of paper. And then some people signed up on list A, some people signed up on list B. I show up, and rightfully so, the comics are like, well, what's the right list? Who's the list? What's the order of the night? Because there's 15, 20 people on every list, right? So you might be number one on the first list and number 20 on the second list. So what I did that night, which I think worked out, was I ripped up both lists, we put the names in the hat, into the lottery system, and I kind of said that I'm never going to be late again because this is not going to work out.
There's mutiny. Yeah, it's
my
chaos.
List, which I have on Excel, the quote-unquote official list of the night, and that's how we do things since then, and it's gone pretty well. But in the minute between settling everybody down and ripping up both ways, one of the regulars that comes there every week lit one list on fire inside the bar, which there's a dozen reasons why you shouldn't do that. So I just kind of, he's a friend of mine. He's been back probably every week since then. But we just kind of moved on from it, and hopefully nothing gets lit on fire or ripped off or no more controversy moving forward.
That was Jack Steiger. I can say this because I brought that up to him on this podcast.
Okay,
so
cool.
And me
and Jack are friends, man. We've been performing together for, I think, all 7 years I've been doing stand-up. I've been working with Jack, and we're still close to this day. But that was one of those nights where, it's hard to explain to somebody outside of comedy why the list at an open mic is so important and why, if there's two of them, the chaos that can ensue afterwards that would have, people ready to fight each other and somebody light one on fire. Would you agree that's a hard, you can't explain it to somebody outside of the game?
Well, it's just like, you know, I showed up early, so on list one, I was like third, you know, so I'm going to perform third, and I'll have like a decent crowd to do it. Then when that list was set on fire, now all of a sudden I'm performing like 28th, you know, so it was
I get why. And honestly, I live, if it's the Brighton Bar to me and I live down the street, I'm not that upset about anything. But if I'm like you and traveling an hour plus to do something, and I didn't go to another mic to come to this one, I understand why people get upset at that. I'll apologize again for being late. And it was a weird night, man. I was in a suit because I had come from a wake. And then it was just a really bizarre situation overall. But, I haven't been late since then. And then we haven't had any real controversy since then. So I think it's going better now.
Yeah, it's just comics are fucking savages, you know. We're just animals. Yeah. And, you know, I think part of it was a performance art, you know, and some of it was just, a protest. I thought it was kind of funny.
Yeah, it ended up being funny and everything moved up. And I think everybody that was there that night has come back a bunch of times since then. The bar was fine with everything. But I think we're having a hard time right now because we can't perform, right? And I think for a lot of comics and a lot of days, even if this is the case for me, that 5-10 minutes on stage is the best 5 or 10 minutes of your day.
Oh,
right?
My God.
So you wake up in the morning, maybe go to a job you don't like, deal with a family situation that's not ideal, boyfriends, girlfriends, whatever it is. And then you look forward from, say, 6 in the morning till 8 at night to get on stage and kind of show your stuff, if you will, or kind of get things off your chest. And then if somebody messes with that, I understand why you're upset or angry or, you know, mad about the situation. I totally get it.
Now, for now in quarantine, it's like, I would love to go 28th. I would love to do it. Like, not doing stand-up, I've written all these, like, I always write new jokes. I want to try these new jokes I have. I wrote a bunch of coronavirus jokes. I wrote a bunch of, you know, quarantine jokes. I wrote, you know, like, I have stuff about my mom.
The conclusion I've come to is, most people think that the game of comp, not the performance, but all the stuff around the performance, the hang, the having to get to a venue early, the traveling, the shows for no money, the shady promoters, all that stuff. We say we don't like that, right? But I'll tell you what, myself and I think a lot of other people are missing that a lot right now. You know what I mean?
100%.
It's like, I think the whole thing is so, like, I think one thing I've always said, I think I'm kind of lucky that I got into it a little bit later than most people. Like, I was in my early 30s when I first started performing. And it kind of gave me an appreciation for, like, how cool it is to be a part of this community, right? And that's one thing. I mean, there's people I don't love. There's situations I wish could be better. I wish I was making more money and I quit my day job? Absolutely. But I think I'm so, like, in love with the community and being able to be a part of it, especially down in Asbury Park, that being away from it for, I guess, close to 3 weeks now has been really, like, it's been hard to deal with a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, just like hanging out with Danny Braff, you know, smoking weed with Tito Cartagena. Like, these are my buddies, like, you know, bullshitting with Richard Dweck, making fun of each other. I mean, like, you know, my
whole
group.
One of my favorite things about stand-up, and this is apart from, like, getting a laugh on stage, which everybody knows is the best thing ever. I love the idea that there's these people in a room that under any other circumstances would never be in the same room and have nothing in common besides the desire to make people laugh and be successful at making people laugh, which is such a broad thing. But if you think about, like, just walk in and take Brighton Bar, for example, any Monday, there's 20 people in that room that would never be in the same room, and they're having conversations, they're collaborating on videos and being on each other's podcasts, like, you're nice enough to have me on yours. And there's people that didn't finish high school in the same room as people with PhDs, and there's poor people and rich people, black people, white people, people from all different parts of New Jersey. And it's like we're able to come together on this common ground of we all love this one thing. Would you agree that's one of the coolest things about what we do?
Oh, I love it. And people, like, in Jersey are, like, super supportive, you know? Like, I was talking about this with Richard Dweck. Like, I have certain friend groups. Like, I'm close with certain people, not close with other people. But we all, like, get along. There's no, like, there's not too much heat, you know?
There's not too much what?
Like, heat. Like, I don't, like, have, like, big rivalries, you know?
Yeah, and then would you agree, too, at our level, comedy beef is kind of stupid. Like, I don't know what we're fighting for at some point. You know what I mean? Like, if it's between me and you for a Netflix special and it's a life-changing money and opportunity, I can understand us having a fight about that, right? But are we really going to get in a fight as two grown men over who gets booked at a dive bar?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to do that at this point in my life. You know what I mean? Like, I've wanted to do your podcast for a while, right? But if you were to pick somebody else this week instead of me, I'm not going to be mad at that other guy because it's like, well, all right, number one, you're doing a lot of podcast episodes. Maybe you'll have me on eventually. And number two, maybe that's just, oh, you got to go on another podcast. Maybe that one's just not going to work out. But it's not like I'm not going to hate Richard Dweck because you had him on before me. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
I love Richard Dweck. We're not best friends, but comedy-wise, I think we do a lot of stuff together, and I'm lucky to get to know him. But I used him as an example because you said you had him on recently.
Yeah, and, you know, he's a great friend of mine. And I have, it's not really comedy beefs. I don't know if I want to get into it, but one or two comics I had a little issue with, but it was from, like, outside comedy, like, just, like, not returning texts and phone calls type of thing where it's like, well,
right. And then, dude, that kind of thing does upset me, too. That I would call, like, not professionalism. Like, I do, in addition to the Brighton Bar, I do book several shows a year. And I would much rather deal with somebody that's not funny than somebody that either doesn't show up or doesn't return texts or doesn't give me a press picture on time or whatever. Because my thing is like, all right, it's my show, but I'm doing everything I can to promote you and get as big a spot on you. Now, granted, I'm going to benefit from more people coming to the show and more media coverage too. But like, if you can't be bothered to give me a headshot to put on a poster on time, how can I be bothered to ever book you on the show again?
I know. It's like, you know, I'm going to promote. I'm going to risk money maybe to promote. Like, can you just send me the email back that we... Especially, like, I had a face-to-face talk with one comic. We were looking at apartments, and I sent him a bunch of apartments. Like, we had a face-to-face talk about it. And I texted him all these apartments, and then I called him, and like, he completely ignored 100% of my texts and phone calls.
Right.
And now I'm like, I don't know if I'm friends with that person anymore. Like, I don't treat people like, if I have a face-to-face with you, I'll at least text you back, oh, no, I signed this other lease, which is fine, right. And that's what happened, but just the not texting or phoning at all when I'm obviously trying to continue that phase, it's like, I don't even know what I'm dealing with right now, you know?
You know what I'm always, what I'm continuously intrigued by being around stand-up comics, right? That you never know if where their onstage persona ends and your real life starts, right? So we deal with a lot of people that go on stage and say some pretty wild things, right? I don't speak to my family. I don't have any friends. I don't do anything all day. I just sit in my house and watch Lord of the Rings, or I'm often drunk by 2 p.m. And then you see the guy grow in public and you realize, wait, some of that's really true and some of it's an act. But when you first meet somebody, you really don't know. Which it's kind of a weird thing because I feel like if everybody did exactly what they said in their sets, we'd have a real bad crew of people. So it's not as bad as people, like, they exaggerate to make it funnier, but we are dealing with a population of people that probably have some, I don't want to say disorders, but like have some kind of personality traits that are not necessarily advantageous in the regular world, and that's why we're in this world. Would you agree with that?
100%. Yeah, it's like where you get to like I tell jokes about girlfriends and it's like that happened one time in my life, but I make it like this is my lifestyle every day. You know what I mean? So it's like I'm really frustrated about this, and so I play it up like this is what's going on, but it's like no, that was, you know, one time, you know.
Right. Yeah, like I do a lot of material, especially at the Brighton Bar, about being like kind of like not made fun of, but like people slighting me. And I make a big deal about, you know, maybe somebody mentioned my name in a podcast and then say something nice. So I'll, like, keep bringing it up where it's, like, just to get a laugh out of it. But then, like, the person will a lot of times just come and, like, apologize to me about it. Like, oh, no, man, that's a joke. Like, we're good. And that's one thing I've actually tried to, like, I let the people know now ahead of time. Like, I'm gonna go in on you a little bit about something you said about me and act like I'm offended. But it's a laugh. We're good when this is over.
Yeah, it's like professional wrestling. It's like you have...
That's what it is, man. It's a good way to put it.
There's material we have to get through. You know, you're the bad guy. You're this and that. But We're going to be cool.
Well, and you know what, too? I think sometimes that much like professional wrestling, and I'm a big hip-hop guy, I think that the rap beat thing is pretty similar. Sometimes it brings out the best in people. Because one of the first times I saw you do a longer set than just a regular open mic was at the Roast of Richard Dweck right around Christmas, right?
Yeah.
And I thought that night brings out those kind of roasts that we do. Now, granted, whether that material can go anywhere else but the Brighton Bar is questionable at best, right? But as far as just making everybody right and having everybody be comfortable and in a good environment and have a good performance, the roast beefs on there have been great, I think, because we're kind of generating that fake beef and making fun of each other and pointing things out about each other we might not have recognized before.
Yeah, that was my best time at the Brighton Bar because everyone had new material. And, you know, I've done, like, roast battles at the Comedy Store. And so, like, when I was – I talked to Richard Dweck about this on his episode. But I was, like, going in on people on the group chat because I was like, it's so hard to write roast jokes, right? So you got to, like I literally spent the second I got booked, like, every night for, like, 5 or 10 minutes – only thinking about how to insult everybody on the dais. You know what I mean?
And dude, the thing that's hard about, well, I mean, I guess you're a regular at the Brighton Bar, right? But at that point, you've been coming a while, so you're in this conversation too, I guess. But if you go to the same open mic every week for 50 weeks for a year, right? And you know the bartenders, you know the bouncers, you know everybody in the room, you know the core in the room, it's fairly easy to write those jokes, right? But if you get invited to a roast battle of somebody where you don't know any of that stuff, it's real hard to really connect with the crowd. Like, as much as I like the Friars Club roast on TV, if you're roasting a dais of super A-list celebrities, it's fairly easy to write those jokes because everybody knows everything about them. Whereas if you're roasting somebody you know or a local comic and the crowd's like their friends and family, it gets a little bit tougher, I think, because you're trying to find things that aren't overly obvious to the general population.
Yeah, that's why, like, the setup of your joke has to be so concise and packed with information. Like, yeah. Oh, I know a secret about this person, blah-de-blah-de-blah. You know, like, you have to, like, tell them some fucked up stuff that you researched and then drop, like, an atomic bomb in the middle of it, you know? I love it. It's such a great craft. I want to ask you this. At the Brighton Bar, besides the burning of the list, and in all your time of doing comedy anywhere, have you ever encountered, like, a fist fight or, like, a screaming match or something like this?
I joke around all the time that if you're not breaking up a fight or administering first aid every couple months, you're not even really doing comedy. I have. A couple fights I've broken up and then a couple, like, medical emergencies I've dealt with over the years. That everyone is okay now. There's been no lasting repercussions from any of that. But, yeah, man, it does happen. You got young people that are, you know, sometimes kind of aggressive towards each other, making fun of each other. Sometimes there's alcohol or other substances involved. And sometimes it doesn't go well for everybody. So, yeah, I've been involved in that a couple times.
Do you want to get into any specifics? You don't have to name names, but
I'm gonna tell a funny story now. From if you're around Asbury Park a little bit, you might remember or you hear comics talk about, like, about 4 or 5 years ago, there was an era where there was an open mic place called Bank on Madison. It's been shut down since then. It was an old bank, and it was this really cool setup where the first floor was like a nice restaurant, and the second floor was like a nightclub, right? It had a DJ booth, the whole thing. And on Wednesday nights, they let me run the upstairs with literally no interaction from management whatsoever. So there was no bartenders up there. I had to go down and get drinks, get food downstairs, and I was the only, quote-unquote, staff person that would ever be on the second level, right? So there's a kid, I'm not going to say any names, he's not in the game anymore. He got my number somehow, he called me one day at my job, like, how do I get involved in stand-up? So I talked to this kid for like an hour, explained to him what to do. Basically, he kept asking questions. The answer to every question was, come to my open mic, see what it's about. If you like it, jump on stage. If you like that, keep getting on stage, and eventually you'll probably get better. So he shows up the first night, and this other kid is a like a regular, but he's kind of like a, I don't want to sound old, like a punk rock hipster kind of vibe the way he dressed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere downstairs at the bar, the new kid thought this punk rock kid was homeless, and they had some kind of interaction about that, right? So then at the end of the night, what I would do is I'd do this bit called One Hot Minute. So say we had 20 comics. They would put their name on the list. They'd write a topic next to their name. And at the end of the night, I'd call everybody back up. I'd assign a topic and go a minute on that one topic, right? Kind of the idea, like a writing exercise to just be a spur of the moment to write stuff. And while this new kid is on stage, he starts calling out the older kid that had been around for a while, and they just get involved in this staring contest, at which point I shut the mic off and put the DJ mic on because I was in the DJ booth kind of hosting this thing, and just kind of I had to break it up from there. And then eventually it didn't escalate to physical violence, but as far as there's probably the most people in the room or anything I've had to break up, and it just is probably the most like tension-filled thing I've been around in a while. Of two guys that I thought were really going to come to blows, and luckily cooler heads prevailed and nothing really came of it.
Well, that's good. That's a little stagecraft. It's like you went to turn off this mic, and then you went to go turn on that mic, and then you, like, the announcer, like, you know, oh, there's nothing to see here, folks, just this and that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know.
And then, like, I kind of put it, once it all kind of calmed down, I put it to the room of, like, this is awesome. This venue gives us the space every week. They're not charging a cover or whatever. They were charging a very low cover maybe. But, I mean, they're letting us do this. If you guys are up here fighting with each other, this is over. They're not going to let us do this anymore.
Yeah.
And then in that same venue, man, it got pretty wild because it was just a younger crowd. And Asbury at the time was a little more, let's say, cutting edge than it is right now. About a month or two after that, there's a comic actually, a real nice guy. His friends came there to watch him perform, and they just got hammered, dude. They were just drinking hard for the whole time we were there. And one of his boys, while he was on stage, got up and fell through a pair of glass double doors. So his face was lacerated and blood was squirting out of his cheek. So I controlled that bleeding, called an ambulance, and they came and took him and stiffed him up. But the funniest part about that is I had to stop the show, obviously. So I shut the mic off to go give this kid medical attention. And then his boy, who was on stage while I'm seeing if this kid's going to make it, comes to me and goes, "Angelo, can you pause my time? Can I get it back when the ambulance comes?" And I'm like, this is the most cutthroat thing I've ever been a part of. Your friend is hemorrhaging blood out of his face, and you're worrying about if you're going to get your 3 minutes left when the ambulance comes.
Yeah, I had 7 minutes, and I did four of that, and then my friend got his face cut up. So do I get three left at the end? It's like, you're not going to put this kid on the ambulance to make sure he's all right at all?
Yeah, it was bizarre. And then I'll tell you what, that night, too, we finished. He got medical attention. And then we went on with the rest of the night. There's probably 10 other comics on the list, and we finished it till 10 or 11 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But, yeah, man, I think it can be a powder keg of a situation when you mix young people, alcohol, jokes, and then it's always new people that don't know how to take stuff. I've really never seen, like, a seasoned comic get in a fight at a show or a mic. Have you?
I was threatened by a pillar of the New Orleans comedy scene one time. He made fun of me, and then I made fun of him back, and he banned me from the Hi-Ho for 2 years. And that was, like, the weirdest thing, because I was like, I literally said to him, I was like, "You made fun of me, I made fun of you, let's be friends." And he goes, "Get the fuck out of here." And I was like, "What?"
Yeah, I think that's one thing that it's a weird thing, because I feel like a lot of people that get to a certain stage in comedy take themselves very seriously. And, like, I'll take myself at the Jersey Shore. At some point at the Brighton Bar, I have to take charge because somebody has to be in charge. You need someone to run the show, right?
Yeah.
But the idea of me being really mad at somebody for making fun of me or not, I don't know, like, I don't see myself doing that. I don't know. Somebody could say something that's really legitimately offended me where I can't ever talk to them again, but that hasn't happened yet.
But, yeah, I mean, would love, I've been made fun of. I love being mentioned. It's like if
you know, you're one of the guys.
Like, exactly.
I think the first, if you're a new comic, right, and you start coming to a mic or a couple of mics that in your rotation, when you start getting shouted out, even if it's to you know, rib you a little bit, that you're part of the crew now. You know what I mean? Like, to me, the next step after getting mentioned on stage, even if it's to get a laugh, is somebody going to book you on their show next. And then after that, maybe if you do well, you get on a podcast, and now you're rolling. You're part of the group. Whereas the guys and girls that never get mentioned, never get made fun of, they're not, to me, they're the ones that are not breaking into the group.
100%. You know, I went to prison one time. I don't know if you know this. I was putting up posters.
I did not.
I was putting up posters for a comedy show in New Orleans, and a meter maid thought my staple gun was a 9mm handgun. And she was giving me a ticket. She's giving me a ticket on my car. I run back to my car with a staple gun in my hand. I go, what are you doing? One thing leads to another. I'm going to jail, okay? So I'm in an orange jumpsuit. I'm walking to my bunk, you know, and I got a mattress in my hand. And all these guys start going, fresh meat, fresh meat. And I go to them. I, like, look them straight in the eye. I'm like, oh, I thought I ordered the wing of the cell with the not rape part of the cell, so I think there's been a mistake. And then they all bust up laughing, and then we played cards, but they punk tested me. And I think in New Jersey comedy scene, like, you get punk tested. Like, if people make fun of me and I freak out, then they're gonna, then it's like, oh, I don't think this guy understands what we're doing here, you know? It's
not true. Like, I agree, man. That's a great story too, about, I mean, not great that you went to prison for having a staple gun and promoting your comedy shows, but yeah, that handled that perfectly. One of my best friends growing up moved out to L.A. to do comedy and improv, and he's out there now. And when I was promoting either the Dweck Roast or the Carl Callen, it was Dweck, because he came home for Christmas, and we went to dinner or whatever, and we're talking. And he's like, when you do these roasts, does anybody ever get mad? And I'm like, no, not really. Like, the people that get invited to the roast all have thick skin and understand what it's about. And he's like, that's funny, because every time I've done a roast in L.A., somebody's been mad, somebody's almost had a fist fight, somebody, like, stormed out of the club. And I'm like, I think part of that is, like, number one, Jersey is such a, like, a like a blue-collar, tough guy kind of place. If you're kind of that soft and thin-skinned, you're not going to make it very long in New Jersey in general, let alone New Jersey comedy. But I think if you look at, like, the backgrounds that most of the people were around, like, you're not going to be that sensitive where if somebody makes a joke at your expense, you're going to make a scene, storm out of the place, try to fight somebody. Where in L.A., apparently, at least my boys' experience, that's not the case.
And New Orleans, too, like, the culture is very, like, live and let live. Like, don't tell me nothing. Like, don't tell me how to live my life. Like,
party town.
You know? And so, and, like, L.A., people, like, you know, they rollerblade up and down Venice Beach, like, shirtless with, like, healing crystals in their buttholes. And if you, like, make fun of that person, it's like, oh, my God, you're so stupid for making fun of that person. Like, you know.
And I'm going to make a very sweeping generalization. And if your listeners want to argue me on this, that's fine, because I'm not even sure if I just thought of it now. But I think in towns like L.A., and to some extent maybe New York City, you have comedians and stand-up comics that are artists, and they look at it from an artistic perspective. It's performance art, and everything everybody says is valid, and there's you want to get laughs, but it's more about, I want to do this for the art, right? I think a lot of us in New Jersey, and maybe there's other off-the-beaten-path places, we were just, like, we were, you know, busting chops in high school, and we're like, oh, my friends think I'm funny, I'll try this. You know what I mean? Not to say we're not artistic, because I think we definitely are, and we are an arts community, no question. But, I mean, my background wasn't Shakespeare. I was never in a school play. I was never in a band. My thing was, like, everywhere I've gone in my life, people tend to think I was funny. Let me see if I can walk in a room full of strangers and make them laugh. And I think that's more of our background than maybe in those bigger cities where you got people that look at stand-up more from the performance art side of it, as opposed to we're just like, I don't know, man. I got a day job doing construction, and people on the job site think I'm funny. Let me see if I can do it at the Brighton Bar.
I think what you were saying about Jersey, like, being culturally more bullying, like, just as a, because, like, you know, I tell that joke about how, like, people in other towns think they were bullied. Like, my friend Matt McGrath, like, signed me up for NAMBLA. Like, he wrote a letter in crayon to the headquarters of NAMBLA, and then old men start showing up to my house with roses. Like, you think you were fucking bullied? My friend in high school tried to get me raped. Like, and that's a true story. My friend Matt McGrath literally did send a letter to NAMBLA with my address, and we started getting magazines in the mail, and, you know, whatever. So it's like, but I think, like, Matt McGrath, he was one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life, and I didn't get mad at him for doing that. It's like, Jesus, he took the joke to a level where now I have to have a conversation with my mom why the NAMBLA magazine is at the house. Like, I thought it was so funny, you know? And it's like, it takes time and care and attention to bully somebody in a practical joke to that level. So when somebody gives me a shout out at the Brighton Bar stage or any stage, I'm like, hell yeah, at least I'm infamous around here, you know?
Yeah, man, I think being known for something is probably better than being unknown for anything. And then, yeah, dude, I New Jersey's such a unique place, man. I love it here. I was born and raised here. I went away to college, and I lived away for like close to 10 years total. My first couple of jobs were out of New Jersey, and then I moved back in 2005. And since then, man, number one, I had to move away to get a good appreciation for it. I didn't, like the typical cliche, you don't know what you got till it's gone.
Oh, yeah.
And then for the last 15 years, man, and I'm probably similar to you living in New Orleans and some other places you've lived, you get back here and you're like, oh, man, it's really great. And the rest of the world wants to point and laugh at us for some reason. But if you look at what we have here in the local arts, entertainment, music scene right now, you look at the small cities that are really exploding like Asbury Park. I'll be honest, man, there's not too many places on earth I'd rather be than in New Jersey right now.
Yeah, I feel like I'm moving from Edison. Well, you know, we'll see what happens. But, like, I want to move to Journal Square, Jersey City, but from Edison just to also have access to Manhattan. But, yeah, I like right. Jersey, man. I just think, like, the people have – and it's weird because, like, I really rub people the wrong way in New Orleans. There was, like, a group of comics that very openly hated me because I did jokes about, like, Caitlyn Jenner. And then they're like, why are you doing that? That's transphobic, you know? And I'm like – are you out of your fucking mind? Like, do you know this person? Like, you know what I mean? Like, so...
Yeah, I don't know, man. We live in such a weird time for stuff like that. The joke I always make is, like, if any of us actually, quote-unquote, make it in comedy, right? It's almost like it's not a question of if, but when you're going to say something that really sets you almost back to square one in your career, you know?
Yeah, just like a tweet, you know, and then all your things are canceled, and it's horrible. But yeah, like, even when the comics were doing that to me in New Orleans, I was like, oh, they're not comics, like, they don't mean anything. And then I just, like,
right.
Like, because I lived in L.A., and then I moved to New Orleans, so I was like, and I grew up, like, watching Dave Attell and Greg Giraldo and Patrice O'Neill and all these, like, at the Comedy Cellar when I was, like, 16, like, was my right. first exposure. So I was like, when I moved to New Orleans and I saw these people doing this, I'm like, oh, none of them are comedians. So I don't right. have to worry about these people.
One thing I always say about that, about the kind of cancel culture we live in, if something a comedian offends you and you want to take action against that person and you're not a comedian, I don't agree with it. I think if they were trying to be funny and it was an attempt at humor, no action should be taken. But I can almost understand that. I don't understand at all comics that want to cancel each other. I feel like if you've been on stage and understand how hard this is, and the idea of, like, oh, it sounded good at the time, I don't understand how you take action against somebody else when you've been in their shoes like that. Do you know what I mean?
Because, like, the funniest jokes...
I just don't get it.
Yeah, the funniest jokes really ride the line of, like, what's good taste and what's not good taste. What's terrible taste. So, like, you write a new thing that's, like, right on the edge, you know, and you try it to try to be as extreme and funny as possible in a certain topic. And then if it kills, then people are like, well, that was way too much. It's like, but the people in the audience who laughed and... That was their vote. So you're gonna outvote their vote with a blog about this situation? To me, it's like, it's disgusting. Anyway,
yeah, go ahead.
You want to talk a little politics?
A little bit, yeah.
Well, so I just came across some statistics. Last podcast, I had Benjamin Fulford on my podcast. The former Asia Pacific bureau chief of Forbes magazine, and we came through some statistics that, you know, when this whole quarantine thing happened, and the government gave $2.2 trillion to Wall Street, which is $6,400 per American, and now it looks like they're going to give out a stimulus bill, you know, sometime in 3 weeks from now, where every American is going to get maybe like $1,200. But, like, when Wall Street's in a little bit of trouble, they give them all the money up front in this first weekend.
Right.
And they set, like, yeah, go on.
You want my take on that?
Go on.
Okay, no, I understand the outrage when you look at those numbers, right? I do, from anybody. And I'm definitely not a super pro big business Wall Street right wing guy. I'm definitely not that. But I'm smart enough to know, me personally, to realize, like, I probably don't understand what's happening at that level of macroeconomics to be able to have an opinion on it. The joke I always make about some of the young comics we deal with, though, that, like, they want to rail against big corporations, but then they're wearing Nikes and have an iPhone. It's like, yeah, I understand maybe we shouldn't bail Apple out, but if we all got these phones in our pockets, can we have Apple fail? I don't know if we can. Does that make sense?
That does make sense, you know, but, like, if you just, instead of giving it directly to the corporations, like, why don't you give it to the people who can then buy iPhones, you know? Like,
right, but if iPhones can't be produced, what are the people going to buy with their money? Like, for example, if you don't bail out massive food corporations like Nestle and you give people money to buy food, they can't buy food because there's no food, correct?
Well, yes.
I would like to live in a world where farmers market and local produce supply all our food. I really would. But that's not the way our society is structured. I'm not making excuses, but I'm saying I think the idea of bailing out Wall Street time after time is sickening to me, right? I think a better example, a better thing I would like to see is put some checks and balances in place where they're not in trouble every couple of years or every decade, where these companies that are supposed to be the flagship of the American economy can go down this easily. If 2 weeks of non-revenue crushes our food supply chain, we need to change our food supply chain, right? More than just bail them out and let them get in the same situation again. That's my attitude on it.
Yeah, like in 2008, like there was the Lehman Brothers shock 12 years ago, and then they crashed the economy, and then they bailed out Wall Street with this TARP, and they're like, oh, well, you know, we have to give Wall Street all this money. Like, they're the top minds in the world. They're privileged people. They got these beautiful brains that went to Princeton, and they're doctors of the economy and this and that. Well, then why did they have so much greed where the economy exploded to begin with? So maybe shoot them instead of give them money, right? Because they destroyed
also,
it.
If we're gonna hold those people, you just said, on the pedestal we're told to hold them on, right? Why is it so easy to outsmart them? Why are there always people like the guy that did the giant Ponzi scheme, or Jeffrey Epstein, that are able to play themselves off as wealthy players in the game when they're not? Why is there constant insider trading allegations? Why is there constant scandals? Like, we're holding them up like they're this massive pedestal of what holds our economy up, but they're constantly racked with controversy and bankruptcies and improprieties, and that's the best of them. You know what I mean? So I agree. If you want, I don't think it will, but if this led to some kind of massive sweeping overhaul where companies had to be more transparent and we couldn't be taking advantage of them like this, I would sign up for that in a second. But as far as what we've actually done, the immediate, put the Band-Aid on this coronavirus problem, I like a lot of Americans, I just don't know if it's the right or wrong thing.
Yeah, I don't know. Just like from an economics perspective, though, like, you know, the Republicans are like, oh, free market, like the free market decides everything. You know, when a corporation has a better product, then everyone buys it, and that's how you keep it honest. But time and time again, Wall Street's bailed out, and the banks that should fail don't, and the corporations that should fail don't. So there's no free market, and Wall Street is now the biggest welfare queen in the world. Like, you know,
they say we sell the idea of a free market, and where the free market does exist is with little guys and small businesses.
Exactly.
Right? If you open two bars next to each other, 9 times out of 10, the better bar is going to stay in business, and the other guy is going to go either file for unemployment or have to go get a day job, right?
Right.
But the problem is, if you're going to bail out both bars and make sure everybody in the town only has the choice, and then pass legislation that allows no other bars to open, so the only competition on that block is two companies, and they're both being subsidized by the government, then it's not a free market at all, right?
Yeah, and that's what's going on over and over.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I don't know. It's like they just prop up their own you know, people at the country club. And anyway, they gave...
You know what, real quick, yeah. I think the saddest thing about this is the last couple of years of politics is that it's become so blatantly obvious what happens, right? And we're all sick of it. We're all disenfranchised. We're all mad about it. We're all making jokes about it on stage with the full knowledge that nothing's going to change. That, to me, as I get older, the more I like the fact that I could go on stage and talk about this. Yeah. I love that I live in a country where I could go on a stage and say into a microphone anything I want, right?
Yeah.
I hate the fact that none of it ever changes. Like, why in 2020 are we talking the same things about the government and the economy that we were in 2000, that they were in 1980, that they were in 1960? I think it just kind of makes me sick the more that we're like, well, Wall Street's crooked, government bailouts don't work, this, and like, no one wants to do anything about it. We just want to make fun of it and post about it on Instagram and just keep paying our taxes and doing what we're doing and not making any real change. That, to me, is frustrating.
Yeah, but that's why I love comedy so much. You know, during the Golden Globes, when Ricky Gervais pointed to all the millionaires in the building and was like, oh, I know, because Jeffrey Epstein isn't here. I know he was your friend. Now you have to take your own plane here. Like, he's talking about the Lolita Express, saying that they were all on the plane. Like, you know, like, that is hard fucking core shit. Everyone in America knows for a fact, everyone in the world knows for a fact, Jeffrey Epstein did not kill himself. That's a meme. That's just common knowledge. And then nobody but the government doesn't do anything about it.
No.
They're not trying to solve that.
Right, and that's a weird thing, too, that, like, if the only people that were using his services were Republicans or Democrats, the other party would be attacking the right. other party, right? But this is the pot calling the kettle black, because everybody was involved. Both the highest members of both parties were involved with him in some capacity, right? So nobody could even be like, oh, remember when you were partying with Jeffrey Epstein? Because they were also partying with Jeffrey Epstein.
And, I mean, if you look at the flight logs, like, there's flight, like, Bill Clinton was there 23 times. Hillary Clinton was there a dozen times. Then the CEO of Victoria's Secret was the major financier of Jeffrey Epstein. Then, you know, it's like you go down, you read the flight manifesto, it's just the senators and congressmen and billionaires. So it's
and the most amazing thing about that is that, number one, they're still largely in power, or if they're not in power, they're still very wealthy, right? Their wealth has not been stripped from them. But number two, if you think about what that means, they were on that flight log, right? That would ruin any regular citizen's life being linked to that kind of activity, as it should, right? But once you get to that certain tax bracket and a certain influence bracket, you are bulletproof. Like, literally, even that allegation can't stop you.
And everyone knows it. Yeah. And so, and there's like a temple, you know, there's like a Freemasons temple on the island.
I'm going to make two declarations here. Number one, I am an unabashed fan of R. Kelly's music. I grew up in an era where that was my introduction to like slow jams and R&B, and I like his music. I am not at all a fan of what he's done and allegedly done with young girls. If for the last 20-plus years, whatever it's been, that's a no-go for me, right? But that being said, how many shows and documentaries and social media accounts have been dedicated to taking R. Kelly down, right? And none of that's dedicated to these politicians and heads of industry that were doing exactly the same thing. Right?
And also, Bill Cosby and R. Kelly are both black men, and it's like, send them to the slaughter. You know, and like what the every single white politician was on that pedophile island. It's like, can we just round these guys up like today? If your name is on that flight manifest, I'm sorry. I don't care. You're done. You have to be done. Your name is on the a flight log going to pedo island. You know,
it's crazy, man. We live in a. We live in this remarkable time where all this information is available. Like, it's not that hard to find this stuff, but yet it's still, like, still nothing happens, which I think is ultimately probably the most frustrating thing of our era, is that we could get this information, as comics we could write material about it, but as a society, we just don't do anything about it.
Well, I think the mainstream news is very good. Like, you know, I think that this whole coronavirus thing, you know, at first they were distracting us with Trump, Russia. Trump is basically Russian. Tulsi Gabbard is a Russian agent. Russia, Russia, Russia. As soon as Robert Mueller takes the stand, okay, that's all nonsense. The key witness goes, oh, well, I heard a phone call from another. So I was in the same room. Another guy made a phone call. It almost sounded like a Russian on the phone, but a friend of a friend of a friend said that. And then they go, this is inadmissible. And he's like, oh, okay, that's it. And they're like, what? Like, that was Russiagate on the Wall Street Journal, the fucking New York Times, CNN for months and months and months, okay? Now they're going, coronavirus, coronavirus. I'm sorry. They have no credibility with me. I don't know if this is real. I don't know anything. Because, you know, look at the last fucking 9 months was Russia, Russia, Russia. None of that was real. So well, they can suck my fucking dick.
I was on another podcast on Saturday night called Totally Local, and we kind of talked about the kids that when coronavirus just first started happening, they were like, I'm in college and on spring break, and they were like having like house parties and frat parties and on the beach with 100 people packed in on the same beach as well. And people are like, well, these kids are so stupid, they're not taking it seriously. But like, if you're 20 years old right now, right, and like your first memory was 9/11 on TV, and you dealt with the housing crisis of 2008, and the news media the way it is, and social media, that's the only thing you know. I understand thinking that the news is crying wolf, this isn't that big of a deal, I'm going to party. I get that. If you're a young person and you've only kind of been lied to in the current era of mainstream news that we have today, I get you not taking this seriously. I understand it.
Yeah. It's like, hey, did anyone arrest Ghislaine Maxwell? Is anyone on that story? No, all of this is nonsense. I don't care what anybody... That's where I'm at. I don't care what anybody yeah. says. They're all fucking liars. They're all pieces of shit. And,
I have to go pretty soon, man, but I just want to run this one idea by you. Do you find some of the most honest, most real things are said by stand-up comics? And if you were to say those things to people in real life, it would be almost impossible to maintain relationships and have a job in the society we live in.
Yeah.
I think about what we can say openly on stage at a mic or a show, and it be accepted, and the wildest ideas can be kind of taken at face value and be something to think about. But just being like, this is I'm not saying anything offensive. I'm just telling the truth. And then, but if you were to do that at a day job or in a school classroom or to a woman or man you had a relationship with, all it would crumble. Like, society's built on the fact that we don't tell the truth day to day the way we do on stage.
And that's like, you know, with roast battle and roasting we were talking about earlier, it's like, you know, if nobody knows this person's history, you know, how are you going to do it? And for me, it's just set up, punch. So when I look at society, I look at, you know, how the news is lying to us. I look at the flaws in Richard Dweck's character all the same way. It's like set up, punch, you know, let's go for the guts, go for the jugular, go for a kill shot. And every time in life, you know, tell the fucking truth. As raw as possible, you know, that's the beauty of stand-up, you know?
Yeah, and I think you can definitely be funny without that element of truth. I definitely laugh at guys and girls that are just kind of like typical joke, dad joke kind of thing, whatever it is. I'm fine with that. But I think if you're going to ever be one of the greats or do something that actually resonates with people, you've got to kind of hit that truth nerve and kind of, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but you got to say something if you're going to be ever talked about, like one of the all-time greats, or even in our little local community, saying that everybody actually gets remembered.
Yeah, you got to take risks, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, if you want to be a professional wrestler that's remembered forever, you got to jump on that top rope and do a backflip and swan dive onto your opponent.
Yeah. I'm not a big wrestling guy. I can tell you are.
No, I'm not. Nick, it's just analogies.
Yeah, it's a great analogy. And if you look at like somebody like Mick Foley, who has or Mankind, he has like a massive kind of like cult following. The people love him. He's not like Jack, like The Rock. He doesn't look like a Men's Fitness magazine model. He doesn't have the best character. But he's got this, like, he's real, man. He just does the wildest things people have ever seen, and he resonates with people.
Well, thank you, Angelo. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. I'm glad we finally got a chance to do this.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care, buddy. That was Angelo Gingerelli. This is Highway Diary, episode 248 in the bag. Later, everybody.